Meanwhile, here in Radio 4 FM, we continue Book of the Week, and Jamie Parker continues reading from Epilogue, American writer Will Boast's extraordinary family story about loss and finding a way of facing the future. Following the tragic deaths of the author's mother, younger brother, and father, a long-held family secret is finally brought out into the open.
Two days before my father's funeral, Nanny, Auntie Sarah, and Auntie Janet arrived from England, unpacking their floral print canvas suitcases, bringing out their crochet hooks and Alan Titchmarsh gardening, antiquing romance novels. This was the third trip they'd made to America for a funeral. The bleary confusion of jet lag and shock must almost have felt familiar. I'd already found the will, tucked in a pocket of my father's briefcase, in with his draftsman's tools and a set of precision gauges. I sat back on my hands, the folders spread out around me, listening to Nanny cooking breakfast, bacon sizzling and popping, the kettle heaving up to a boil. Strange, all that bustle in our house. It had once been filled with music. Mom ironing along to Camelot and Phil Collins, Dad and I bopping to Miles and the Modern Jazz Quartet, the ecstatic squall of Rory's jam bands. I had an appointment that morning at the law firm that had drawn up my dad's will. I reached into the bottom drawer of his desk and felt around, one last OCD check to see I'd gotten everything the lawyer might need. My fingertips brushed something. I pulled out an old, yellowed folder labeled Marriage/Divorce. I registered this with dull, sleepy surprise. The documents were stamped in red, with a symbol of the crown and the words Southampton County Court. In the bottom right corner were two signatures and the date, 1st July, 1975. My eyes ran over the form again, searching for the names. One was my father's, Andrew Boast. The other read, Helen Boast. I didn't have time to think it through. Nanny was calling me.
Come on, Will, get a move on.
The law firm was in the next town over, a squat brick building between a gas station and a clock factory. The junior partner skimmed the documents I'd brought, tabulating dollar amounts in the margin of his legal pad. He turned the pad so I could see, a satisfied smile on his face. I couldn't speak. The number he'd come up with. There were more zeros behind it than my notions about my class status could contain. The bulk of the money came from an insurance settlement over Rory's accident, a wrongful death suit. "When I'm gone, Guy," my dad used to say, "you'll be taken care of." But I hadn't thought he meant all this. "I don't know if these change anything," I said. I gave the junior partner the divorce papers. His smile drooped. At home, Nanny, Auntie Sarah, and Auntie Jan were sitting down for their late morning cup of tea. Mechanically, I poured myself a cup. "How did things go with the solicitor?" Nanny asked. "Okay," I said. I took a few swallows of tea, a bite of my chocolate digestive, and suddenly I couldn't wait any longer. I had to know. They reacted in a gentle way, smiling shyly and looking down at the carpet. I don't remember now who responded to my question first or what exactly was said, but the short of it was that, yes, my dad had been married once before, years before he met my mother, when he was only 19. His first wife, Helen, had been a good deal older than him. "We were going to tell you," Nanny said. "We thought it best to give it a few months, let things settle down first." I could only nod yes to what they told me. Yes, yes, that seemed right, that seemed sensible, and finish my tea and biscuit. "What a surprise," I said, trying to be cheery about it. "I really can't believe it." Auntie Sarah stared out of the window, and then sighed. "Will," she said, "there is one other thing. I had two brothers. Two half-brothers, to be exact. Arthur, living in Brighton. Harry, living in Southampton. Did they look like my dad? I felt somehow they didn't. Or that if they did, they must be imposters. Bogus versions of Rory and me. If I couldn't picture Arthur and Harry, they didn't exist. And if they didn't exist, I didn't have to write to them. Over 30 years, there'd been almost zero contact with that part of the family. My dad had separated from Helen when Arthur was 9 and Harry only 7. From that point on, Auntie Sarah told me, he'd been cut off completely. He wanted to see his boys, but his phone calls went unanswered and his letters were returned unopened. He sent presents at Christmas. They were sent right back. The things I was told impressed upon me one very clear notion. My half-brothers might not be people I wanted to know. But in the end, it was curiosity that got me to write the letters. Curiosity and a sense of duty. Whoever Arthur and Harry were, they ought to know a little about my dad and what kind of a man he'd been. I started roughing the letter out, keeping the tone polite but cheery. I knew Andrew as a very private person who enjoyed working around the house and in the garden. How careful, how bland. It took me weeks to write those letters. But as soon as they dropped through the mail slot, they swung right out of my thoughts. I had other things to worry about, not least the bills and paperwork having to do with my dad's death piling up. On top of this, my half-brothers both went by their mother's maiden name, Cartwright, which made them seem even more distant to me. The idea that two men out there shared half my blood remained tenuous, unreal. Every week, when we were growing up, my dad would write my mom a check for cash. $125 for the entire week. Just barely enough. And pinned it underneath a pickle-shaped magnet on the fridge. She was used to his stinginess. It was just that there were always little extra expenses. Rory and I needed new trainers for PE. Rory's grade was taking a trip to the observatory and lunch was $5. And each time she had to go to Dad and ask, and he'd write her another check and make her feel that she was bankrupting the family. He did, however, relent on buying a second car, a sporty little Renault Fuego. She got her hair cut short and spiked it up with gel, and driving around town with her sunglasses on, she felt foreign and exotic. Back in England or Ireland, a year could feel like one dreary, damp blear. Here, spring came on like a riot. Suddenly, people were friendly. They waved to you over their steering wheels. That odd Midwestern wave, a quick flip of the wrist, like brushing away a fly. They nattered away to Mom in the grocery line. They kept coming up without even introducing themselves, saying, "Hun, I just love your accent." Rory and I had made friends with Cal and Bree Meyer, and Mom made friends with their mother, and soon we were all streaming back and forth to the lake. Mom had Rory and me strip down and change into our trunks on the beach. Who was bothered about seeing little boys' backsides? Until her new friend, Julia, told her, "Nance, that's not how we do things here." Every time she had to correct herself, to readjust, part of her was being chipped away. Sometimes, out in the country, when she turned the Renault into an empty street and without thinking started driving on the left-hand side, she didn't even startle, but just kept going, waiting for something to correct her. It's the 4th of July, Independence Day, and we're sprawled on a blanket on the sand. Everywhere around us, people sweating in lawn chairs, sitting on coolers. We pass around a big jug of ice water, so cold it's metallic, drink from the spout, drenching our shirts. Mom and Dad are smoking, tipping their heads back to exhale, elegant, not like Americans, sending up trails of smoke. Past the end of the pier, the no-wake boy keeps slapping against the water, then gulping back up. Dad leans back on his elbows. We clamber over him and his big belly, but he doesn't want to play. We wrap ourselves in the blanket, huddle close to Mom, and wake to her shaking us gently. Time to go, sweethearts. A storm coming. The fireworks have been canceled. But all up and down the shore, people are firing off their own private displays, sparks shooting off, then fizzling in the shallows. With summer approaching, I booked a flight to England. It would be a relief to be home, a good long span of dull, uneventful calm. But in the weeks before the trip, things started getting bad. As I sat down in a restaurant with friends, the floor started to slide away, the walls leaned in, collapsing. I muttered some apology and got out of there quick. These things I'd learned about my dad had hit me like a muffled blow, the kind you shake off at first, don't even know you're hurt. My grandmother collected me from the airport. Red brick terraced houses stretched out on either side of the motorway, the cement monoliths of council tower blocks looming among them. Rust-spotted container ships bulked dirtily on Southampton water. We went out to see Nanny's brothers and sisters, in dim, underheated living rooms crowded with overstuffed settees, I sat listening to my great auntie's talk. Everyone was very gentle about my dad. A good man, they said. When I told my great aunties and uncles how I'd learned about my dad's first marriage and his two other children, they quickly changed the subject, as if to say, well, never mind about all of that. I took the train to Salisbury to see Auntie Sarah. We had tea and watched quizzes on the telly. At 10, I yawned conspicuously and excused myself off to bed. Will, Auntie Sarah said, a letter came for you. Came last week. The name in the top left corner of the envelope. Arthur Cartwright. Arthur thanked me for my letter and apologized for not having responded sooner. He'd known he had two half-brothers since he was 21. He'd always felt he'd one day find a way to reconnect with my part of the family. About 10 years ago, he'd done some traveling in America. I contemplated contacting Andrew, he wrote, but doing so might have caused incalculable damage, and I decided against it. I stopped and read this first part again. Incalculable damage. What did that mean exactly? When I went down in the morning, which for me came well past noon, Auntie Sarah made me sausages, bacon, black pudding, and eggs. She sat down to her own breakfast, a bowl of oat bran. When she spoke, there was a wary note in her voice.
While you were having a lie-in this morning, I was taking messages for you.
Arthur rang again. He says he'd like to meet.
Jamie Parker was reading Epilogue, a memoir by Will Boast. The book was abridged by Miranda Emerson and produced by Gemma Jenkins.
My castaway this week is the campaigner Dame Julia Cleverdon, an inveterate networker who's been described as a magenta steamroller. She's never happier than when she's working a room.
My fingers itch every time I arrive in any gathering as to who's doing what. Could I learn more about what's working? How could X be made to do Y? My daughters say I'm completely impossible, really. Can't have a conversation about anything other than how the world might be changed.
Dame Julia Cleverdon, my castaway, I do hope you can join us to hear her Desert Island Discs this Friday morning at 9.